person's full name. Jehovah Epicurus Donatien Darouet Mason. I always stumble somewhere in that name, as if part of me fears what would happen if I recited the full, unbroken invocation. Come in. Chapter the 26th. Madame Darouet. Come in. I know the trick to opening that door without it squeaking. Many do. False windows on the four walls of the chamber showed the seasons. Spring blossoms, summer peaches drowning in emerald leaves, harvest wheat and grapes, ice-dusted evergreens, all painted, with painted birds and animals playing in the fields. There were painted children, too, life-sized, so they seemed to stand with the viewer in the room, leaning out through the false windows, trying to catch birds, pluck fruit, sporting as seasons demanded, snowballs in winter, flirting in spring. The furnishings were delicate to the point of fragility. Gilded candelabra, fine as twining vines, couches on slender legs which curved like swan's necks, tables with dainty seats ready for card players, and a harpsichord, petite, like the runt of a litter of pianos. Did you expect a throne room, reader? Never. Madame is no queen, but a hostess, and rules none but the guests in her salon. Madame, allow me to present Mademoiselle Thisbe Sanier of the Sanier Weeksbooth Bash, and the Reverend Dr. Carlyle Foster, a fellow of the Censeur's Conclave, and protégé of Her Holiness Conclave Head Giulia Doria Pamphili. Madame curtsied her greeting. No simple gesture, but a grand process, as the heights of her wig, its white peaks crowned with ruffles and dyed feathers, dipped and rose like the crags around Olympus, nodding their respect to passing gods. Her gown today was midnight blue, open in the front over an inner gown of rosy salmon laced with gold, with a wide framework underneath which made the skirt swell to more than thrice the lady's width, as if she waded in her own private ocean. She wore gems on her fingers, her wrists, at her throat, not distracting, but serving her body as gems should, their glitter luring one to notice the curve of an arm or the slope of a tender breast. The face that stared back at the new arrivals was a painting, the precise, stylized ideal which stares from every flattering portrait that ever graced a palace wall in the age when men's portraits showed distinct features and character, but ladies were homogenized into one doll-perfect face. It really was all paint. The heavy makeup of the period, whose whites and rouges did not let a single hint of skin peek through. Her age? She seems more a time-stopped goddess than a woman whom the count of years could touch. And sometimes I wish our anti-aging drugs were less powerful, so one might see what greater transformations maturity had planned for such a beauty. It is not polite to discuss a lady's age. So I shall say only that, were all the seven leaders of our world assembled in one room, Madame the Eighth, only Headmaster Faust would recall more of history than she. Mademoiselle Thisbe, Dr. Carlyle, I continued, may I present Madame Darouet, also His Grace Ganymede Jean-Louis de Lettremouille, Duc d'Étoile, Prince de Talmont, President of the Humanists, and His Excellency Chief Director Hotaka Ando Mitsubishi. I assure you, reader, the pair beside me were no less startled by Madame's illustrious company than you are. Golden Ganymede lounged against the summer wall, his diamond sparkle finally in a setting as brilliant as itself. Across the room from him stood Director Ando, dignified, but with something of the harried look of a man who has just rushed to replace his pants. Actually, the director was not wearing pants, but pleated hakama, whose belts and knots require much more time and skill than trousers. For at Madame's, he exercises the option of wearing the 18th-century period costume of his own country, marking himself a foreign dignitary among so many Parisians. Ganymede, of course, always dresses the same, but here it feels normal. Pleased to meet you, madame. Enterprising Thisbe drew the folds of her cloak up into a makeshift curtsy. The pleasure is mine, my dear. Madame approached and embraced Thisbe like a sister, the pinkish tint of her forearms set off by the long, trailing ruffles of salmon lace which framed her half-length sleeves. It's high time one of your household came to visit mine. I'm sorry if your initial reception was a bit rough, but the back door is not the best entrance for new guests. Thisbe accepted Madame's jasmine-scented kisses on both cheeks. But more interesting, she offered. Madame's smile liked that. I suppose so. And dear Dr. Carlyle, please sit. From what I've heard, you've had a very tiring few days encountering Dominic and Mycroft and my son. Before Carlyle saw it coming, Madame had kissed the cousin and swept him over to a daybed, where she plopped him down and settled down beside him, her vast skirts filling the space between the sensaire and curving couch arm as blankets fill a cradle. Yes, Carlyle confessed to the warmth of her inviting smile. It's been awkward. Of course it has. Of course it has. And for my part in it, I'm very sorry. Sit, everyone. Sit. Sit. She gestured Thisbe to a vacant love seat opposite. And thou too, Mycroft. Thou art the very picture of exhaustion. Take the corner stool before thou fallest down. I bowed. Thank you, madame. Good. All settled. Now how can we help you, good Dr. Foster? Madame glanced at the president and director, who pulled up ibis-slim chairs to flank her and the sensaire, like family gathered around a troubled child. You're concerned about my son? She asked. Carlyle's tongue faltered beneath the president and chief director's stares. Duke and chief director, I should say. In this house, Ganymede is far more duke than president. Come, speak your mind, Madame chide. We're all friends here, whatever we may be outside. You have worries? Thisbe spoke up, her smile growing more tickled is the word. Are you J.E.D.D. Mason's mother? I am Jehovah's mother, yes, Madame answered. Carlyle managed not to wince this time. And you run this place? Yes. Which is a brothel? Madame chuckled at Carlyle's timidity. You mustn't be scared of the word. I usually call it a gendered sex club. I offer archaic sex with old-fashioned gender-differentiated men and women. My clients like to seduce or be seduced and enjoy skirts and breeches rather than the neutered egalitarian copulation one gets outside nowadays. Whom did you meet on arrival? The Chevalier? Did you like him? Carlyle swallowed hard. So you don't do anything more extreme here? Madame's laugh was indulgent as a nanny's. I hope you don't think that badly of black laws. Though nearly impossible to spot among her skirt's flare, there was a black law hiveless sash about her hips. Our clients get quite enough of the thrill of the forbidden with gender. The cousin frowned. I'm surprised people find gendered costumes that exciting, frankly. Oh, my dear, she chuckled at his innocence. Human culture spent, 10,000 years working out ways to code exciting gendered sexuality into every shirt and gesture? Our poor 3 centuries without it simply haven't had the time to develop anything to match. Her eye caught on me. It's like a language. A young, invented language with a couple thousand words might manage baby books and street directions, but Voltaire, Shakespeare, the profound peaks and doggerel troughs of literature, those take 1,000,000 words. Many of my clients find what we offer here quite addictive. Carlyle's wrinkled nose showed that he found the thought odd. So, this is all just historical reenactment? In a sense, yes. she added warmly. Although, since you ask about the forbidden, Doctor, in the intimacy of this room, I will confess there is one more borderline thing that goes on here. She caught a sparkle in Thisbe's gaze, and, smiling, sparkled back. Though we make sure it harms no one. You see, my guests enjoy reenactments of 18th-century intimacy, particularly the forbidden and scandalous sides thereof, not only my gendered ladies and gentlemen, but the Enlightenment art of mixing forbidden sex acts with forbidden things, especially forbidden talk. Carlyle frowned. Meaning? Oh, just the sorts of philosophical debates that were scandalous once upon a time. Equality, human rights, rational government, cultural relativism, freedom of religion, specific religious views. The sensei frowned. You're saying you discuss theology while having sex? For beginners, it's before and after, mostly. Managing it during sex takes skill and concentration. It's our unique service. Since discussing religion is even more taboo today than it was in our dear 18th century, it makes the most thrilling erotic talk. I'm sure you've run across this sort of thing before, Dr. Carlyle. Professionally, I mean. Not in so institutionalized a form, but yes. The sensei smiled almost smugly. It's what I expected, really. Oh? Your inscription, Deo Erexit Sad, built for God by de Sade. It's a bit too literate for someone who would read Sade so narrowly as to think it was all about sadism. You're using the religious half of Sade, attacking the sensei system. I would never attack the sensei system, Madame contradicted, holding a hand against her bosom as if wounded. I told you, we are very careful. What happens here is fun and play, not danger. Taboos are thrilling, and my guests enjoy breaking taboos, especially the triple mixture of sex, gender, and religion, stacking forbidden things to build a richer thrill. No need to worry about bringing this to the attention of the sensei's conclave. They know. We have many sensei's on staff here, Dominic among them, tasked with making sure that things stay safe, and the conclave sends inspectors frequently to watch for proselytizing. Whenever it's a group of three or more, we have a sensei chaperone to certify the discussion non-proselytory. I believe the consensus in the conclave is that my establishment is healthy for the world. The urge to break the religious taboo is common enough, and it's better that it be concentrated here, where it's carefully monitored and directed toward harmless play, than to leave people to vent the same impulses in secret meetings or visiting reservations where you have no jurisdiction. Thisbe's smile faded as she found herself on less familiar ground. What does proselytizing have to do with the Marquis de Sade? Ask your sensei, Madame encouraged. Sade is still on the standard syllabus, is he not, Dr. Carlyle? Carlyle perked at the invitation to ply his trade. Their reputation aside, Thisbe, a lot of Sade's writings were moral and philosophical. They did precisely this taboo-breaking thing Madame is describing, mixing sex with philosophy and theology, usually by literally alternating them in the text. Sex scene, philosophy, sex scene, philosophy, and so on. Sade equated racy, forbidden sex acts with radical ideas, like atheism or criticizing the king. It was a lot like that Diderot stuff about nuns that Heloise quoted, encouraging the readers to question what's meant by natural when both celibacy and sex can be defined as perversions depending on how you look at it. Madame's eyes beamed approval. An admirable summary, Dr. Carlyle. But our Marquis was more experimental even than Le Philosophe. My favorite example is his proof from design. Carlyle smirked, recognizing it, but let Madame continue. Nature, according to the science and theology of the Marquise's day, makes all things to fit where they belong. Forest animals with brown fur, Arctic animals with white fur, predators with sharp teeth, herbivores with dull teeth, Round pegs in round holes on a world scale. With me so far, Thisbe?
Yes, she answered, cautious.
And before Darwin, people used that as proof of the existence of God.
Precisely.
Now the penis is round and the anus is round, while the vagina's opening is long and narrow. Clearly, then, nature designed the penis to fit into the anus, not into the vagina.
Thisbe snickered. That may be the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Precisely, Madame confirmed. The Marquis is parodying 18th-century scientific logic. If you want to throw away his proof of the naturalness of sodomy, you must also throw away St. Thomas Aquinas' proof of the existence of God from design. Sod took all sorts of things, gender, religious and moral concepts, all by experimenting with acts, or at least descriptions of acts, which reverse those prejudices. Since in our modern day, discussing religion has become risky again, just as it was in the 18th century when anything radical could get you executed, the thrill is back too. And our dear Marquise's questions are still worth asking, even if today we have more rational laws and open-minded leaders.
I see it, Thisbe conceded, then brightened.
Yes, I see it. It sounds fun.
Carlyle did not brighten.
Why are the president and director here? He asked, looking to the VIPs who flanked them in silent approval.
A nod from Ganymede invited Ando to speak first.
I'm here at the moment for family business, the chief director answered.
Carlyle's light brows furrowed.
Family?
Sparkling Ganymede glanced at the cousin, then gave Thisbe a smirk of quick judgmental humor. She smirked back.
Carlyle, really, you haven't heard the rumors?
He frowned.
What?
Tycoon.
That's the nickname the Mitsubishi use for J.E.D.D. Mason, isn't it?
Chief Director Ando nodded, not really smiling, but his face perhaps a little warmer now.
Cardi couldn't get across to me the 15 or so things the nickname means, but Jehovah's actually your child, aren't they, Director?
That's what Mitsubishi circles say, that despite being adopted by the Emperor, J.E.D.D. Mason is actually Chief Director Ando's child.
Carlyle blinked, dazzled.
I never believed.
Then, President Ganymede, you're J.E.D.D. Mason's uncle?
Duke Ganymede sighed at the sensei, as at a newcomer at a banquet who lifts the dessert fork first.
Chief Director Ando has been married to my sister for 28 years.
Can't expect him to publicly accept responsibility for a bastard child of 21. What an eccentric suggestion.
Ando's face revealed nothing.
Suffice to say, Tycoon is very dear to me, and I was glad to see my friend and colleague Cornell Mason secure a place for the child where they would have access to the very highest circles. Mason, meanwhile, has been happy to have my help raising Tycoon, since we're both such busy people.
Carlyle's puzzled gaze shifted from the director to Madame, to Duke, and fixed at last on Thisbe.
So, like an unofficial makeshift bash, Thisbe suggested, stretching back cat-like across the silken seat as she savored the mystery's solution.
Or a marriage alliance, Madame suggested, between two royal houses.
Who do you think convinces the Masons not to push too hard for a new census, even though their population's grown enough to merit another senator? Or who do you think gets the Mitsubishi not to raise rents on the rest of us when they own more than half the globe?
Madame's breast within its bodice swelled with mother's pride.
He's a very important boy, my son, the Prince d'Arwe, a pillar of friendship between the Masons, Mitsubishi, and humanists.
A personal alliance.
Thisbe is always happy to be right.
So, which one gets to be called Monsieur d'Arwe, the Emperor or you, Director?
Voltaire, Carlyle answered softly.
What?
Voltaire's real name was François-Marie Arwe, before they changed it to Voltaire.
Sticking de on the front makes it sound aristocratic. It's the sort of thing ambitious women aiming to become king's mistresses used to do.
Madame concealed her smile behind a fan of deep blue ostrich feathers veined with gold. If the patriarch is no longer using the name, why shouldn't I? After all, Voltaire was my inspiration, he and his age. Don't you mean Madame de Pompadour at her age? Carlyle challenged. That's what you're aiming at here, isn't it? The age when kings, mistresses ruled the world? I'm not aiming at anything, she answered, painted lashes fluttering at the suggestion. I have created a period venue where clients of a particular taste can vent their unorthodox sexual appetites. If, as a side effect, my son and I have encouraged peace and stability in the world for 2 decades, I don't expect anyone will complain. Carlyle tried to slide away from Madame along the sofa, but politeness held him mostly fast. And what about you, President Ganymede? He asked. Why are you here, paying an avuncular visit? The cousin was not worthy of the Duke's full gaze. I was born here, but I'm here now to retrieve Thisbe Sanir. He turned the murder-blue diamonds of his eyes on her. I thought you were more cautious than this, Thisbe. What if you'd been caught using the confidential data your Bash is trusted with to infiltrate a secret stronghold which I didn't happen to frequent? I'm sorry. There was frankly little apology in Thisbe's apology. Her expression was like a child's at that moment. A child clever enough to find the hiding place where Mom and Papa have secreted some stash of candy for her birthday, and she accepts their admonishments, but in the same breath reaches for her chocolate. Thisbe collects us, you see. She was born to Urbash's secrets, but she collected me, the Major, Bridger. Now what a triple prize to set beside us in her spellbook. The President, the Chief Director, and this bizarre Madame. Thisbe, the Duke President reconquered his member's attention with a toss of his golden mane. If you were concerned about how the Prince d'Arouet was handling the case, you should have come to me directly. You know this must be handled delicately. His eyes locked on me for a stabbing instant. My trembling was my apology. Excuse me, President Ganymede, Carlyle interrupted. Did you say you were born here? Here we prefer, excuse me, your grace, Madame corrected. And yes, he was. His sister, too. Part of my dear family, born and raised here, like Dominique and Eloise and the Chevalier. Inside a brothel? The Duke's eyes locked on the censeur like a hawk about to dive. We lived upstairs. The pit is downstairs. And if you're calling my sister something vile, then there's a dueling arena downstairs where such things are settled. Carlyle's limbs withdrew into the cloak like a retreating crab. Cousin's law doesn't allow dueling. You could find a champion. Please, Your Grace, Madame intervened. We must forgive newcomers for being new. Of course. It was Director Ando who seconded Madame's forgiveness, and with such force that Ganymede had to let it go. Madame smiled it all away. Anyway, it's not uncommon for a Bache house to have a business in part of it, as yours does, Mademoiselle Senir. Your wonderful cars. Nor is it uncommon for some of a Bache's children to join the family business while others work elsewhere. Speaking of which, Mademoiselle Senir, I hear you up for another Oscar. Congratulations. Thisbe cocked an eyebrow. Nominees for this year aren't going to be announced for another 2 weeks. I know. Again, Madame's fan hid her smile. But she let it sparkle in her eyes. The smug allure of secret knowledge. Carlyle, less secret fluent than Thisbe, was still struggling to keep track. So Director Ando married President Ganymede's sister, who was raised here in the same Bache as the Masonic Porphyrogene? The cousin's face strained just from outlining the web of what could be labeled neither incest nor nepotism, but smelled like both. Another marriage alliance? Precisely, Madame answered, glowing. So the humanists, too, trust my Jehovah, and let him help maintain the balance between the hives. That's why he was asked to take care of this black sakura mess.
Was it an arranged marriage? Carlyle accused.
Danae and Director Ando?
Princesse Danae or Lady Danae,
the Duke corrected.
And no, it was not.
Carlyle's breath grew harsher.
I talked to Eloise.
The Duke's eyes narrowed.
What about Sister Eloise?
They were going to have an arranged marriage, the fiancé who had been chosen for them. And they weren't acting, were they? They actually live like a nun here, think like a nun, and worship your son Jehovah like a god.
His eyes fixed on Madame. The gendered boys and girls you raised here aren't just playing. You've raised them to think inside this box. Like Eloise, you probably got Danae to believe the marriage was voluntary, but everything was planned. Am I wrong?
Spitfire Carlyle didn't give them time to answer.
Period costume is one thing, but we got rid of gender roles to free people from this kind of mental subjugation. You've undone that. You've raised children in such a way as to intentionally limit their potential and cripple their ability to participate and interface naturally and productively with the world at large.
A warning bell went off in all our minds. That last sentence wasn't Carlyle's. It was nurturism. A quote from the infamous bill proposed in 2238, the height of the anti-Set-Set riots, when, in the name of kindness and free will, the nurturist faction tried to add to the short list of universal laws that bind even black laws this grim eighth, a ban on raising children too strangely. The law that was defeated at such cost. Madame stretched back across her sofa.
I don't feel particularly subjugated. Then why is your male child the tribune, not you? Carlyle accused. Why aren't you an imperial familiaris, or a player in the humanist elections, or a senator?
I prefer exerting this kind of power. I could have the other, but I don't want to.
Separate spheres, Carlyle accused.
Out of curiosity, madame,
he pronounced the title with disdain, did you do sensei training research on Rousseau as well as Sade?
Do you know a Jean-Jacques reader? If there were three lights of the Enlightenment, the third was Jean-Jacques Rousseau, as brilliant as Aristotle, as disruptive as Alexander, as mad as good Saint Francis. Whatever grand goal the Enlightenment took up, he managed to somehow support and attack it at the same time. The Age of Reason celebrated the possibility that science would improve the human condition generation by generation. Rousseau agreed, but cried that this would only make us wretched by pushing us further from the noble savages' lost tranquility. The Age of Reason speculated that women might be no different from men if they were reared the same. Rousseau agreed, but cried that this would strip women of their rightful thrones, unmaking society's peacemakers, and making men grow harsher without a fair sex to temper their passions. Even blood-feuding enemies must negotiate civilly, in Madame de Pompadour's presence, he would say. Not so Briar Casales, since she is free to wage a feud herself. If newspapers and common discourse hailed Voltaire as patriarch and Diderot as le philosophe, Rousseau was known tenderly as Jean-Jacques, a fragile firebrand, always in need of sheltering lest it burn out, and ladies around the world wrote of how they wished to rush to and embrace this dear, romantic advocate of inequality, who they felt knew their fragile heart so well. Jean-Jacques became the favored spokesman of those women who, perversely but sincerely, wanted to remain pet queens within their gendered roles. To temper your confusion, reader, I shall not call Rousseau she, but I am tempted. Madame smiled.
Well guessed, Dr. Foster. I did study to be a censeur, and Rousseau was my first favorite.
It was in Rousseau I first discovered that there are forgotten powers only women used to wield, and my own experimentation proved they still work today, extremely well, in fact, since no one's on guard against them anymore.
Experimentation, Carlyle repeated. Tell me, then, did you lose your sensei license for sleeping with your parishioners, or for abusing their personal information?
The affront to the lady's honor spurred both Duke and Director to rise, but she forced peace with a smile and dainty, restraining gesture.
That is a fair question. In fact, I left without qualifying. I discovered early on that I prefer the boudoir to the conclave. I don't fancy a life in which I couldn't share theology with friends as fully as I prefer.
Thisbe laughed aloud, and Carlyle spun on her, eyes hot.
"You think this is funny?" he snapped.
"I think this is awesome."
"Awesome? It's sick."
"Carlyle, I've seen the sensei's conclave, and this room is frankly a lot more comfortable. Madame here is a competent adult. If they wanted to go into politics, they could. Instead, they're exercising supreme political influence while getting to enjoy fun clothes and comfy sofas. How is that bad?"
"But women's liberation happened, what, 400 years ago?
But there's still residual bias, even if no one wants to admit it. There are always more biologically male political and business leaders than female, at least outside you cousins.
Look at the 710 lists. Briar Cassell is the only woman on most of them these days. I think it's good to see another woman on top.
So what if Madame's taking the back door into politics? It isn't cheating any more than President Ganymede is cheating by being blonde and gorgeous. No offense."
The Duke nodded.
"Are you really asking Madame to give up the power they've created for themselves here?" Thisbe pressed.
"What about Eloise, then?"
The cousin thrust an accusing finger at the door, as if imagining the nun caged beyond.
"What about the other kids Eloise said they competed with when young? There must be ladies to go with the Chevalier and company, but we didn't get to see them because ladies sit in their rooms like fragile baby bunnies and embroider all day or whatever. Madame is raising them to live like slaves, and you're okay with that?"
"Like Setsets?" Thisbe shot back on Eureka and Sydney's behalf. Fighting words, these, reader, as cousin and humanist see themselves on opposite sides of riot lines, protesting for and against Abash's right to use or misuse Brill's arts to make their children into those intricately programmed geniuses which neither side can call anything but happy, productive, and completely mad. Even though gentle Carlyle hesitated in the presence of the sleeping dragon of the Setset riots that 2 centuries ago so nearly introduced the world to war. Carlyle took a long, deep breath.
"This isn't like Setsets, it's sexual slavery."
Thisbe rolled her eyes.
"Now the cousin shows their colors. Throw sex or violence into something, and it has to be evil just because you say so."
"That's not it at all. Sex is in everything, Carlyle, and anyone who pretends it isn't is heading into battle with one fewer weapon in their arsenal. It's as true in the Senate and the Conclave as it is here. If you don't believe that, you need to get laid."
After a moment's shocked pause, they laughed together, Madame, the Duke, Director Ando, healthy belly laughs, as when one of Madame's creations, still in childhood, would toddle in upon the adults in their pleasures and ask, "Does that tickle?" as only children can.
"Oh, my dear Thisbe, you must let me kiss you."
Madame did just as she threatened, placing a more than sisterly peck on Thisbe's willing cheek.
"Witch, I apologize, master.
I want to obey you, but she's a witch. I can't explain it to you any other way.
Look at her. Look at the two of them, witch and whore. The two black sides of womankind. They recognize each other, surely as viper knows scorpion, or assassin knows thief, as they brush shoulders while visiting the same unsavory back-alley toolmaker. Look how quickly Thisbe takes to this, how comfortably she sprawls across the well-named love seat. Would Leslie take to this so easily? Would Aldrin? Toshi Mitsubishi? Mama Doll? See how even the cousin Carlyle cringes. Yet Thisbe is already trading smiles with Madame, like the electric ripples with which eels signal the boundary between my hunting ground and yours. These gazes are mutual admiration. Madame and Thisbe admiring each other as the sprinter admires the weightlifter against whom she will never vie. Their games do not share the same goals, not even rules. But they do use the same pieces and the same board, this same fragile blue orb.
Art thou finished now, Mycroft, venting thy lunacy?
Yes, reader.
Good. Then let this outburst be thy last. My patience and forgiveness end here. Henceforth, I warn you, I shall skip any delirious paragraph with witch in it.
But reader, no!
Wretch, thou art as mad about women as thy Jean-Jacques. I will hear no more of this. And if thou triest to test my patience more, I may begin to skip other absurdities as well. Thy fevered talk of miracles, thy Bridger. This is thy final warning.
I'm going to talk to the conclave, Carlyle announced, as much to himself, I think, as to the room. Madame's smile rained adoring condescension down upon the cousin.
About what, dear?
I told you, the conclave knows.
About Jehovah, Epicurus, Donatien, whatever, whatever, the theology, the illegal part.
The matron blinked. There's no law against a black law or grey law having a religious name.
Or are you going to argue it's proselytizing?
Setting aside the proselytizing of encouraging Eloise to worship J.E.D.D. Mason like a god, no one, certainly not my son, has ever encouraged that. In fact, my son quite disapproves, and has commanded Eloise with the most extreme strictness not to recommend the practice to others. But Eloise is as entitled to freedom of religion as anyone, even if her choice is a very rare one.
Carlyle frowned, but decided to move on for now. I saw J.E.D.D. Mason in action at the Senior Weeks booth, Bosch. They talked about religion, other people's religions, my religion, in front of groups of people without anyone's consent. That is against the black laws.
No.
Hotaka Ando Mitsubishi broke his long silence here. The foreigner, whose dark kimono, plain black hair, the stiffness with which he sat upon the corner of his seat, all lent him an air of separation and objectivity which calmed even Carlyle a bit.
What do you mean, Director?
Have you seen Tycoon use theology in circumstances where something else more dangerous to the world order was not already taking place?
He had to admit.
No.
The first law bans religious discourse, or proselytizing more specifically, under the rubric of action likely to cause extensive or uncontrolled loss of human life or suffering of human beings. I don't know what comments you heard, but I am confident you will agree that they were not proselytory, and they were done in the service of protecting the global transit system, which is a much more immediate threat of uncontrolled loss of life and suffering.
Ando took a deep breath.
Theology is Tycoon's weapon, and Tycoon is an officer of the law. Would you rather we had licensed them to kill, as we have Occam Sunir?
Carlyle took some moments to think.
You mean it's purposeful?
They incapacitate an enemy using theology?
Instead of violence.
Yes, Ando confirmed.
Tycoon sends enemies to censers instead of hospitals, and leaves them with insights instead of scars.
Imagine how many lives we could save if every policeman in the world were armed so gently.
Carlyle did imagine, and from his pallor I suspect he had Giulia Doria Pamphili in his mind's eye, the razor words with which he slashes to the heart and, like a surgeon, leaves the patient sounder once the wounds are healed.
Tycoon's task in this world is to solve things, the chief director continued, leaning so he could fix the cousin in his sights without losing his view of sparkling Ganymede. They keep the rivalry between Mitsubishi and the Masons from becoming harmful to the public good.
They will catch this black sakura thief and protect the cars before real damage is done. If, among their tools, they employ a few non-proselytizing religious comments, that benefits the world, and often benefits the people who are stimulated to new reflection by the contact. He paused here to let Carlyle disagree, but the censeur had nothing. "Though Madame Darway does not have any official government office," Ando continued, "their occupation is similar. To solve things. Whether that means tempering relations between myself and Mason, or giving those downstairs an outlet for desires which could be disruptive and dangerous if expressed outside. Here the Duke and Emperor and I can talk face to face without the whole world watching. You would be surprised how many crises have been averted beneath this roof." Two quick knocks sounded at the door. "At last," Madame cried, smiling again at half-calmed Carlyle. "Your escort's here. Let her in, Mycroft, let her in." I opened the door and watched shock drive all the anger from Carlyle's face. "Chair Casala?" Thisbe released a long, low whistle as she arrived. It was Mom herself, the cousin chair, Briar Casala, her borrowed black cloak hanging open in the front, so a sliver of her cousin's wrap spoiled the scene with its modernity. "Carlyle Foster, right? Are you all right?" "What are you doing here?" Carlyle rushed to her, glad to have something sane to cling to in this mad new world. She smiled. "We had an appointment half an hour ago to talk about Mycroft Canner, and why you're not allowed to tell the public they've been made a servicer. Did you not get the message?" Sorry, I haven't checked my messages today. But how did you find me?" "I got a call. Are you okay?" Ganymede's sharp eyes guessed the call was mine. Carlyle gaped. "You know about this place?" "I'm the outside inspector." She flashed her credentials. "You know all brothels have cousins inspect to make sure no one's being abused?" "You do that personally?" Carlyle's face was bright already, healed by Briar's arrival as everything about her promised normalcy. Her modern slouch, her guileless smile, even the plain wedding ring on her finger, a silent promise that she had no part in this madness. "These days, this is the only one I still inspect myself," she answered. "I wouldn't trust anyone else to do it here. Neither do they." She nodded to her colleagues. "Hello, Director, Your Grace." They returned silent nods. It was Ganymede's duty to introduce his own. "Briar, may I present Thisbe Sanir of the Sanir Weeksbuthbash?" Casala was not close enough to offer a handshake. "Pleased to meet you, Member Sanir." Take this moment, reader, to ask yourself whether you would mistake these two for one another on the street. Thisbe Sanir and Briar Casala. They are both women of India, Briar slightly taller, Thisbe slightly paler, their inky hair long and almost always loose, but Briar's hair always falls behind her like a cape, while Thisbe's surrounds her throat and shoulders like a shadowed hood. "Briar, dear," Madame invited, "kindly explain to poor Dr. Foster why it's perfectly legal for me to raise my girls and boys the way I do." Casala offered Carlyle a sympathetic face. "You know the set-set issue. I personally check on this bash house regularly, and make sure the kids are given access to standard education and ideas, and allowed to leave and pursue a different lifestyle if they want to. But if you raise them so they're incapable of normal life..." "Carlyle," Thisbe interrupted darkly, "when you hear set-set issue, that's your cue to shut up." Casala turned sympathetic eyes on Thisbe. "That's right. Your bash has set-sets, doesn't it?" Thisbe did not soften. "Eureka Weeksbooth and Sidney Coons are the two happiest people I've ever met." Casala tried a smile. "Exactly. I respect your concern, Carlyle, I really do, but the law's clear. However you raise your kid, you're pushing them in some direction, shaping them with languages, if nothing else. So long as the direction you push is going to make them productive and happy, there's no justification for interference. It's legal to raise a set-set. It's legal to raise an Italian. It's legal to raise a cousin, and it's legal to raise an 18th century lady or gentleman. Right, Thisby? Still no smile from the ice-eyed humanist. Yes, my hive fought hard for that right. And sensei or specialist or no, I will not have a nurturist inside my botch. Here, reader, was the only moment where I longed to raise my voice among my betters. Thisby's history was plain wrong. 200 years ago, when the 8th law of vote loomed, it was not the humanists who battled it. Mycroft Mason fought it, certainly, but even more than him, it was Utopia. Those strangers behind their visors who see the true sun less often than Eureka. Utopia knew, when the case went to trial, that if this 8th law passed, if it was judged legal for Lindsey Graff to kidnap children from a set-set training bash, that it would be the floodgate. Next, all is one. The mighty, angry earth would descend upon Utopia, as Catholics used to descend on Protestants and vice versa, to save the other's children. Terra the moon baby would be the excuse. The Utopians could protest all they liked that they did not anticipate the astronaut's pregnancy, that early complications made the trip back to Earth too dangerous for mother and fetus. But in most minds, Terra is still thought of as intentional. A lab rat. Happy. Indispensable. Who taught us more about space adaptation than 1,000 simulations, but still a lab rat. Short-lived and crippled from gestating on the light and airless moon. If Utopia was willing to do that to one child, Earth accused, what might they be doing to others beneath those visors? How long until cyborg U-beasts made from iguanas and dogs and horses had human pieces too? Fear forced Utopia to act. They chose a gentle protest. When the Graff Trail began, they called it sick, indefinite stasis, as they put it. Not one, not hundreds, but all 400 million at once. The laboratories, factories, think tanks, presses closed. For 3 weeks, the world tasted life without 400 million vocateurs. Hate rose, and fear, all the arrows of complacent Earth against Utopia. And it was that threat which steeled Mycroft Mason to step onto the Senate floor and stop the Nurturist's 8th law at any price. Your hero gave his all for them, reader. For Aldrin, for Voltaire, for Apollo Mojave, not for his Masons, not for Eureka Weeksbooth, not for you. Then clearly thou art well named for him, Mycroft, thou whose verse on verse recitest this litany of Utopia with thy namesake's passion. Namesake? You flatter, reader, but I am not named for Mycroft Mason. Rather, we both were named for Mycroft Holmes, elder brother of the fictional detective. Mycroft was smarter than Sherlock, almost omniscient, and with his greater wisdom mocked his brother's attempts to champion justice. Mycroft Holmes spent his days gazing out through the windows of the Diogenes Club, watching the infinite tapestry of urban life, and doing nothing, save when government commanded. Carlyle breathed deep. You're right. You are right. I'm sorry, I snapped. I'm not a nurturist, really, I'm not. I don't object to set-sets. It makes me uncomfortable, but I recognize why it's right that it's allowed. I embrace the principle. And maybe what you're doing here is actually beneficial. I just... You've had a hard 3 days. Briar Casala clapped her fellow cousin on the shoulder like a drinking buddy. Come on, Carlyle. I'm going to take you to lunch and answer all your questions about Mycroft Canner and Jed Mason and all this. Sound good? Carlyle relaxed into a slump at last.
Wonderful. I can't thank you enough.
He turned eagerly to the door, and hope beyond, but paused.
One more question, madame.
As many as you like, my dear, she invited, that portrait face smiling so perfectly. Carlyle had to steel himself.
Who named Jehovah? Was it you?
Jehovah Epicurus Donatien Darway Mason, she recited. Carlyle looked to Thisbe.
Donatien is the given name of the Marquis de Sade.
Madame nodded confirmation. All the prince's parents picked out pieces of his name. As a censeur, I don't think you would want me to reveal to anyone who chose which. Finally, Carlyle had a smile for her.
That's true. Thanks for catching me.
She smiled back. I still know how to think like a censeur. I also think Jehovah's a good name for a person who saves lives by wielding theology instead of a gun. Carlyle took a slow breath.
Eloise's fiancé was the Emperor, wasn't it? The great and worthy man who could approach Jehovah Mason as a father to a son. The Emperor was supposed to marry Eloise, just like the director married Danae. That's a pretty uncomfortable age gap.
That's two questions, Chair Casella chided. Come on, Carlyle. No more politics for you today. You're politicsed out. I prescribe a good French restaurant. She glanced back over her shoulder. See you later, Director. President Ganymede. Carlyle lingered, a stubborn foot in the doorway.
Thisbe, will you be all right here?
With my own president? Thisbe shot back, chuckling. Mycroft's making you paranoid, Carlyle. I'm thrilled to be here.
All right. I'll see you.
Around, she finished for him. I held the door for the two cousins as they left. Cosella glanced down at me. I might call you, Mycroft, if Carlyle has questions later.
I'll be ready, Chair, I promised as I closed the door behind.
Mycroft Canner. I heard Carlyle whisper my name like an incantation just before the door closed. Perhaps we smelled alike to him, me and Madame, the same kind of monster, as when a remote village starts finding bodies in the woodland edge, mauled by claws and jaws too huge to be common woodland fauna. And it does not matter whether the killer be wolf or bear or dinosaur, the threat is still the same. Extinct things rising. Torture. Humanity was supposed to be past that. Gender, we were supposed to be past that too. With the cousins gone, Madame stretched back across her sofa, glowing with satisfaction like a cat between two naps.
Well, gentlemen, did you get a good look?
That's the child, no doubt, Ando answered gravely. Ganymede nodded agreement.
Thisbe, that young censeur of yours is a gag gene, and must be kept away from here at all costs for his own sake more than anything. Children can leave this house, and he has proof. Will you watch him for me?
Thisbe's cheeks stayed still, but I saw her eyes sparkle with delight. Another secret for the spellbook.
Of course, Member President.
Good. Now come with me. We're getting you back home. And then I'm meeting with your Bache about this whole affair. If you have problems, they're the whole hive's problems. Time we settled them. I have rarely seen so eager a nod from Thisbe.
Thank you, Member President. We've been hoping for some more direct intervention.
She turned to the hostess now. And thank you for your hospitality, Madame. It's been most enlightening. She laughed at her own joke.
I'd love to come again, if I may.
Why, I'd be delighted, dear Thisbe. I shall talk to membership about an invitation for you. Madame kissed her goodbye on both cheeks. Duke Ganymede can slide like a dancer, strut like a cock, or march like a soldier. He chose the last, dragging Thisbe toward the door by force of command. I opened the door for them, and handed in the sack with Thisbe's boots and weapons. Thisbe's arts, your grace. The Duke does not thank slaves. Director Ondo rose now. I'll go too, if we're done here. Yes, we're done. Thank you, Hoteka. I knew if anyone could recognize the child, it would be you and Ganymede. See you tonight? The chief director kissed her hand before departing. Until tonight, madame. I expect your presence tonight too, Mycroft, he ordered, raising his eyes to me for the first time since I had entered. We'll have work for you. Yes, chief director. I closed the door behind him. Then I faced madame, alone at last in her salon. Nicely played, madame. Very nicely played. She appreciates that sort of compliment from me. Thank thee, Mycroft. Now, she shooed me like a pigeon. To thy work. Chapter the 27th. The interlude in which Martin Gilbreaker pursues the question of Dr. Cato Weeksbooth. Call logged 11:11 Universal Time, March 26th, 2454. Seneschal. Not often notre maître asks a question like that. Guildbreaker. Dominic, where are you? Are you hurt? Seneschal. And he asked it in front of Caesar, no less. Do the Utopians ever turn down an application to join the Hive? He looked straight at Aldrin when he asked it too. He actually looked. And did you see how pale Mycroft turned when he heard it? I'm surprised the little stray's tracker didn't summon Papadelius. Guildbreaker. Dominus is really worried about you. The others may not see the difference, but I can tell. Seneschal. Well, do they turn applications down? Guildbreaker. The Utopians? No, never. I had Aldrin check. Seneschal. You don't see it, do you? Guildbreaker. I do see it. There's someone Dominus thinks would want to be a Utopian but isn't, so they wondered if their application was rejected. I'll act on it. But you need to come back and tell us what's happening. What have you been doing for the last 3 days? Seneschal. Seconds before that question, he'd asked Aldrin how long until the next Mars launch. Here's your hint. I heard notre maître ask Cato Weeksbooth the same thing earlier that day. How long until the next Mars launch? And he got just as accurate an answer. Then he asked Weeksbooth how long the Senior Weeksbooth Bash had been humanist, and the blessed little coward didn't know. Guildbreaker. Cato Weeksbooth? Seneschal, I leave it to you. I've found richer hunting. Guildbreaker. Dominic, what? Call ended 11:13 Universal Time, March 26th, 2454. From the notes of Martin Guildbreaker. At 14:22 Universal Time, on March 26th, 2454, I arrived at the Chicago Museum of Science and Industry to interview Dr. Cato Weeksbooth. I did not give prior notice so that Dr. Weeksbooth would not have time to consult the other members of the Senior Weeksbooth Bash before accepting. I was directed to wait for Dr. Weeksbooth in their office and found it remarkable that a volunteer should have their own office. The office contained tanks with fish, mice, frogs, crickets, and a very large ant colony, and was decorated with pictures of famous scientists and photographs of Dr. Weeksbooth with children at science fairs and locations of scientific interest. Notable were 5 framed handwritten paper letters from former students thanking Dr. Weeksbooth for inspiring them to pursue careers in science, 3 of the 5 mentioned receiving significant prizes. In each case, the letter was framed so as to be partly covered by a photograph of the author as a child. I scanned the letters and determined 2 peculiarities. First, in all 5 cases, the photographs had been carefully positioned to obscure points in the letter where the author mentioned having joined the Utopian Hive. Second, my scanner confirmed that the stains on all 5 letters were tears. Many people value gut instinct, but in my experience, gut reactions make it more difficult to objectively pursue an investigation. I could not shake the sense of murder.